Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Joe Lambert. My registration number is 38071, and I represent the defendant and the appellant in this case, Robert Martin. The question presented in this appeal is whether the Supreme Court's decision in Shuler is still viable. If that decision is viable, the jury's award of lost profits damages to the plaintiff in this case must be reversed. The plaintiff in this case has never done any business of any kind. It has never had revenue, it has never made a profit, it has no prior track record, it has no financial statements, tax returns, or anything else which would indicate any potential for profitability in the future. Plaintiff's sole member and shareholder, Mr. Freeman, likewise has virtually no business experience of any kind. During the trial, Mr. Freeman described Tradewinds as simply a piece of paper sitting on a shelf. Tradewinds didn't enter into any contracts or any subleases with any prospective tenants for its proposed hangar, and with the exception of some nominal copying costs and architectural fees, Tradewinds invested virtually no money in its proposed hangar leasing business. Tradewinds' proposed hangar leasing business was Mr. Freeman's dream, and it was his concept. Nobody's ever done anything like this at the Colorado Springs Airport. Tradewinds simply went out and hired a damage expert who was basically willing to say anything. Mr. Levis took a vast array of hypothetical numbers and projected 40 years into the future, and that's the year 2048 that we're talking about. 40 years into the future, how much net profit a company which has never been in business might make with a hangar which was never built in an industry which no one else has undertaken. Shuler expressly prohibits this type of speculation and conjecture, and the jury's verdict in this case must be reversed. The jury should have never been permitted to consider this evidence. The general rule for lost profits, I think that we can all agree, or both parties agree at least, is that lost profits are recoverable only if they can be proven with reasonable certainty. And the Supreme Court's recent decision in Denny Construction, 2009 case, noted that historically the rule of reasonable certainty has almost always been applied in the context of established business ventures. Important quote, I think, from Denny Construction says, historically then, we have relied upon the rule of certainty, that is, that the loss of profits from the interruption of an established business may be recovered where the plaintiff makes it reasonably certain by competent proof what was the amount of his profits to weed out speculative claims for lost profits. I think consistent with the Supreme Court's observations in Denny, virtually all of the cases decided in Colorado, all lost profits cases, deal with established business ventures. Shuler, however, was one of the only two cases, I think, in Colorado which dealt specifically with lost profits in the context of new business ventures. The plaintiff in Shuler attempted to seek lost profits in circumstances virtually identical to those here. Like Tradewinds here, the plaintiff in Shuler had no operating history, had never made a profit before, and lost nothing real or tangible as a result of the defendant's wrongful conduct. And like Tradewinds, the plaintiff in Shuler hired an expert who provided an opinion as to the hypothetical value of a radio station which had no prior track record of any kind.
Mr. Lambert, what is your position to the argument that real estate concerns may be different than speculative radio stations?
Well, Judge, I think that we pointed out in our reply brief, the trial in this case occurred in April of 2008. Subsequently, last summer and last fall, as we've seen, the real estate market has completely fallen apart, not only in Colorado, but across the country. And I think it's completely unrealistic to say that in good economic times, every single commercial landlord's going to make a profit. Especially, and what's happened in the last year simply confirms that point. There's no guarantee at all that, or to say it better, I think, is real estate income is no more certain than any other form of lost profits. Again, under the plaintiff's view, any human being could come in and make these profits over a 40-year time period. Doesn't matter who you are, doesn't matter what your experience is. You simply come in, you buy this hangar, you lease it out, and you make 40 years' worth of lost profits. Let me talk briefly about Mr. Levis. As we noted in the briefs, Mr. Levis had two components to his analysis. The first thing he did is he went out and he found a range of per square foot figures for construction costs for this proposed hangar. None of those numbers had anything to do with Tradewinds, had nothing to do with Mr. Freeman. Mr. Levis just looked at various materials, some of which were taken out of a November 2005 sales presentation, and some of those numbers were taken out of a June 2005 appraisal. But those things were done for the project as a whole. The whole project was a five-acre piece of property. What Mr. Levis did is he went in there and said, well, I'm going to look at the five-acre piece of property as a whole, and I'm going to look at the appraisal that was done. I'm going to take numbers out of those. But I think it's important to note that none of those numbers had anything to do specifically with Tradewinds or specifically to Mr. Freeman or specifically to Tradewinds' proposed hangar leasing business. Mr. Levis came up with a construction cost for the proposed hangar, and then he engaged his associate, Mr. Fellows, to review industry data from across the country, looking at similar hangar leasing businesses across the country, rental rates for those hangars. And Mr. Fellows, again, didn't do any appraisal of Mr. Freeman's or Tradewinds' hangar. He simply took numbers from across the country, gave those to Mr. Levis. Mr. Levis looked at the numbers and said, I'm going to pick that number. And most of the numbers were on the high end of the range that Mr. Fellows provided. And Mr. Levis took all of these hypothetical numbers and came up with 40 years worth of lost profits that Tradewinds would have made, you know, had the hangar been constructed, had Tradewinds been able to lease the hangar. And I think it's important to look at the plaintiff's exhibit 8 and 9, which are attached to our opening brief. It's very incredible for Mr. Levis to come in court and say, Tradewinds would have made the same amount of profit in year zero, in year one, year two, year three, year four, all the way up to the year 2048. And Mr. Levis said that Tradewinds would have earned $61,000 net profit every single year into the year 2048. The bottom line is that Mr. Levis did exactly what the expert witness in Shuler tried to do, and that is to value a hypothetical business without any regard whatsoever to the specific operations or experience of the business or its management. And I think there's several important policy reasons, as we point out in our reply brief, supporting the result and the rule in Shuler. As stated in Shuler, a new business venture must at least establish with reasonable certainty the amount of future damage related to actual operations or to real particular transactions. And I think this case is a prime example of that. You know, as we noted in our reply brief, Mr. Levis's calculation for lost profits, he used a number of $7.24 per square foot as a rental rate. Again, and that was purely hypothetical. That had no connection whatsoever to Tradewinds or Freeman.
Did it have any connection to an industry average for similar businesses?
Not at the Colorado Springs Airport. Again, what happened is Mr. Fellows, who's an appraiser in Colorado Springs, provided data of hangar leasing businesses across the country to Mr. Levis. Mr. Levis looked at the ranges and he simply picked a number from, you know, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but he simply picked a number, and $7.24 happened to be on the high end of this. So I think it was within the range that Mr. Fellows reported, but again, this number had no connection whatsoever to Tradewinds or Mr. Freeman, and there's no evidence at all that Tradewinds could have ever leased its hangar at all, much less that it could have done so at $7.24. As Tradewinds notes in its answer brief, Mr. Freeman did approach and speak with a single prospective tenant for the hangar at some point in time. And I think if you look at Exhibit I, and I think this came out during Mr. Levis's cross-examination, Mr. Freeman was proposing that Mr. Wickliffe lease this proposed hangar at $4.91 per square foot. And going back to the policy reasons in Schuler, Levis in this case wasn't bound by any tangible or real facts. He simply could go out and say, well, gee, I'm going to pick the highest number I possibly can, and that'll, and out comes a very large damage figure. So I think that's another important policy reason supporting the rule in Schuler, that you have, that if you're a new business venture, you have to at least be grounded in fact to some degree.
Mr. Lambert, how is this distinguishable from Cope, where there were specimen trees and there was a prospective buyer from the trees, and what you were just explaining here is there was a prospective tenant for the hangar?
I think the difference is in Cope, I think Cope is very fact-specific. In that case, the plaintiff had developed a new business of developing or selling wholesale or selling specimen trees on a wholesale and retail basis. And he had actually found trees in Montana that he contracted to purchase. They fell at a specified price per tree. And he had a probable buyer, as the opinion says, a probable buyer in Colorado, I believe, for those trees. And the defendant worked on his trailer and on the way up to Montana to get the trees. Wheel came off of the trailer. Plaintiff was unable to pick up the trees and he lost a sale. I think that's much different than what's going on here. In that case, in Cope, the court said, well, at least with respect to this particular transaction, we'll let you seek lost profits. Cope didn't say we're going to let you seek lost profits for 40 years. So I think Cope is limited to a real transaction involving a contract that was entered into with a prospective buyer for the trees. So I think that's far different than what's going on here. In this case, Tradewinds had no hangars or Tradewinds had no tenants at all for his hangar. I mean, it did approach a single tenant for the hangar, and that tenant eventually said, "No, I don't want to rent this hangar." So I think that's far different than than the result in Cope. In addition, if the jury's verdict is allowed to stand in this case, a new business venture could always win huge awards for contract breaches, even in the absence of any past managerial experience. And all the business has to do is retain an expert like Levis, who's willing to come into court, professional expert testimony, who's willing to come into court and give that opinion for a fee. And I would like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Cato Cruz of the law firm of Rothkerber Johnson & Lyons, and I'm counsel for the Appellee Tradewinds Group, LLC. And I'll be referring to my client as the purchaser and the appellant as the developer. Now, before I get to the points that I'd like to address with the court, I'd like to say that the jury's verdict should be affirmed in this case because the evidence at trial was that my client's damages were based on more than the mere anticipation of owning and subletting a hangar. My client established its damages at trial within the reasonable certainty required by our jurisprudence, and the jury received proper instructions on the law informing its deliberations over my client's damages. Now, I'll first address the reasonable certainty requirement of our jurisprudence with regard to proving damages. I will then discuss the record evidence demonstrating the basis of my client's damages in more than the mere anticipation of owning and subletting a hangar, and those damages being established with reasonable certainty. Finally, I will discuss the developer's prior judicial admissions that the purchaser's sole remedy in this case is for lost damages. Now, it's always been the rule in Colorado that damages may be recovered if proven with reasonable certainty. The rule of reasonable certainty has been interpreted to only require that, together with the fact of damage, the plaintiff must submit substantial evidence sufficient to enable the trier of fact to determine a reasonable estimate of the plaintiff's loss. And that comes from the Pomerantz case. Thus, the absence of a prior history of profits does not create a per se exclusion of lost profit damages if there is other sufficient competent evidence. As this court has held, the distinction between a new venture and an established business is one of degree, which goes to the weight to be given any evidence of lost profits. and that's from this court's decision in Cope versus Vermeer Sales and Services of Colorado. So while a showing of past profits is relevant to the issue of lost profits, it is not dispositive. The policy the developer advocates here, which is that a startup may only recover lost profits if it shows prior profitability and the loss of tangible business opportunities, would encourage parties to breach contracts with impunity when contracting with a startup business, as the developer did in this case. This is why our jurisprudence has specifically found no room for a per se rule with respect to a showing of past profits in order to recover lost profit damages. Now, the developer's reading of the Shuler case as establishing a bright line rule ignores the pronouncements of our Supreme Court with respect to the rule of reasonable certainty and the lack of a per se rule requiring a showing of past profits as a prerequisite to recovering damages for lost profits. I'd like to reiterate the point made in the answer brief, and this goes to Judge Lichtenstein's question, that the jury awarded my client damages for lost rental income. The evidence at trial was that my client contracted to purchase a metal building shell, an airplane hangar, which it would sublet for periods of time in exchange for charging rent. So we're not talking about running a business in the sense of manufacturing products or providing a service to a broad customer base. This distinction is important because given the difference in the nature of the damages sought by any given plaintiff, our courts take these cases and apply the rule of reasonable certainty on a case-by-case basis. So what's reasonable and sufficient proof of future damages in one case may not be reasonable and sufficient in another. But what the developer is asking this court to do is apply a one-size-fits-all Shuler rule, but our jurisprudence tells us otherwise. Now, the record demonstrates that the purchaser's damages in this case are based on more than the mere anticipation of owning and subletting a hangar. Most notably, the purchaser secured the developer's legally binding promise to build and sell my client a hangar that my client could use for subletting. The testimony at trial was that my client invested hundreds of hours in the project in part performance of the letter of agreement. Now, many of these actions are cited in the answer brief on page 13. I'm not going to go into those that are cited there, but I want to point out that these actions included my client meeting with the airport development manager, who confirmed my client's authority to sublet his hangar. My client conducted research to determine rental rates for different sized hangars at the airport. He spent about $1,000 in architectural fees and copying costs for building design drafts with respect to his hangar, and he met with a prospective tenant who was initially interested in renting my client's hangar. Moreover, the evidence at trial was that my client had prior experience as a commercial landlord and many years of experience owning, operating, and maintaining aircraft and leasing hangar space at the Colorado Springs Airport. In these respects, my client's actions are like those of the plaintiff in the Cope case, where this court held that when a party demonstrates more than the mere anticipation of starting a business, the distinction between a new business and established business is merely one of degree, and it goes to the weight to be given the evidence.
Mr. Cruz, let me ask you this. Is there a line that you draw between out-of-pocket expenses, like some of the examples you were given, like the $1,000 that was spent, versus anticipation of lost profits? Where will you draw the line?
Well, I think the line is dictated by the standard of reasonable certainty. That was certainly evidence before the jury that my client was out of pocket $1,000. But there was also the evidence of all this other activity, specific actions, the hundreds out of hours that he invested in this project in furtherance of his business. I think all of that is encompassed within the rule of reasonable certainty. So in that respect, I don't believe there's necessarily a specific line you draw. I think it's you take the standard of reasonable certainty, you apply that to the facts that are there before the jury, and ultimately it's up to the fact finder to determine whether or not that reasonable certainty standard has been met.
Well, does that need to relate to an actual transaction, or can it relate to a speculation of what would happen had there been a transaction? Does it need to relate to an actual transaction? Does there have to be a real transaction that this is relating to, or can it relate merely to the speculation of a transaction that might occur?
I'll answer that by saying this. I think we disagree with the developer in the sense that the developer ties the reasonable certainty standard to a specific transaction. I don't think that that's specifically how our courts interpret the standard. I think it's reasonable certainty is tied to, again, the facts of the case. So in this case, there may not have been a specific transaction. In other words, a specific tenant that my client had lined up for subletting his hangar. However, the evidence was tied to this specific hangar project. Mr. Levis testified at trial that he relied on the letter of agreement, which is the subject of this case. He relied on the 2005 marketing sales presentation that the developer had developed, that the developer was using to market his projects to prospective purchasers. Mr. Levis relied on that. He also relied on the 2005 real estate appraisal that the developer had prepared on his behalf for purposes of this project. So here you have an expert relying on information specific to the project, where this hangar is going to be, where the hangar is located, thus where it's going to be sublet. So in that respect, I think reasonable certainty, so long as it's tied to something dealing with this business, it doesn't necessarily have to be tied to a specific transaction, but I think we would agree that it does need to be tied to certainly this business that's going to be conducted. And in this case, there's evidence in the record that Mr. Levis's testimony and his calculations are based on evidence dealing with this specific hangar project.
Mr. Cruz, it seems to me that there's two factors here. One is the argument that you have to have had an existing business in order to claim lost profits. And your argument is that's not true. And under COPE, if you have an anticipated business under certain circumstances, the jury could find, as a matter of fact, that you might have lost profits. Is that your argument?
That is my argument, Your Honor.
But the second piece of that then is that you have to prove your lost profits. And would you agree that then you must prove that by more than mere speculation?
Yes, I agree.
So there has to be a reasonable expectation of certain lost profits.
Yes.
My difficulty with this case is that what you have is certainly an agreement to build a building, but everything after that seems to be based on if the building floor plan looked like this, and if it was owned for this many years, and if it were rented out at this rate, how does that come out to be a reasonable expectation when these things are assuming that market values of such buildings will go up, that rental rates will go up, or that there'll even be customers, that it'll ever be full 100%, or that there'll be vacancy rates, et cetera?
Sure. I have two responses to that. One is when you look at the standard that the Colorado courts discuss in terms of proving damages, the Colorado courts discuss establishing your damages based on essentially the best evidence that you have under the circumstances of your case in order to prove or reach this reasonable certainty. So that kind of couches or begins the analysis for what type of evidence or what type of information would be sufficient in a case like this, given the circumstances, many of the circumstances in which you've described. I think that, though, what Mr. Levis testified to is a little more concrete, perhaps, than some of the if that you've maybe perceived or inferred based on the briefing. So, for example, in terms of the 40 years, Mr. Levis didn't just pull that out of thin air. That comes from the ground lease between the developer and the city of Colorado Springs was a 40-year ground lease. And so that information is put before the jury to leave it to the jury to determine, based on all the evidence the jury's heard, what period of time would the jury believe or find that my client would hold this hangar within that 40 years. So that comes from something concrete. Notably, I think what Mr. Levis testified to demonstrate that his numbers and figures are based on more than just pulling things out of thin air. One is he testified about Tom Fellows, who's a qualified real estate appraiser, and he communicated with Tom Fellows to make sure that Mr. Levis did, to make sure that Mr. Levis's conclusions were reasonable. Because Mr. Fellows is a real estate in the real estate business. The construction cost estimates per square foot contained in the exhibit that Mr. Lambert referred to, which was Plaintiff's Exhibit 9 at trial. It's in the record at 229-54665. But Mr. Levis testified that the construction cost per square foot came directly from the 2005 sales and marketing presentation that the developer had prepared for this specific project. Some of the expenses that Mr. Levis relied on came directly from that same presentation. The estimated vacancy rate of 5% came directly from the appraisal that the developer had commissioned concerning this project. So, yes, Mr. Levis was required to use his expertise, his qualifications as an expert, to research certain market data and use certain numbers there based on some of the admitted lack of information involved in this case. But he tempered that with also trying to tailor things to this specific hangar project and also using specific numbers and specific facts pertaining to this project, all of which came to bear in formulating his opinions. If I can, with that background, contrast that with what the expert did in Schuller. The expert in Schuller grabbed a trade publication, found five or six different radio stations in the trade publication and said, hey, these five to six other radio stations would have had profits of X, Y, and Z, and I think this plaintiff would have had those same sort of profits. There was nothing tying this plaintiff's damages to either a tangible business opportunity or anything specific to that business that plaintiff in that case was intending to run.
In Cope, the claimant was actually driving to Montana to dig up trees that he'd already purchased. What specific conduct by your client in this case rises to that level of, you know, call it part performance if you wish?
Sure. I think there are several points. Some of those are at page 13 of the answer brief. But he did things that furthered the entire project, which benefits my client because it assists my client in also marketing his hangar, making sure there's value there in his hangar so that he can sublet it at a particular price. But for example, some of the things on page 13 include him arranging some of the promotions for the public sales meetings, assisting the developer in drafting certain leases for the project and so forth. But I think more in line with the Cope case is my client confirming his authority to sublet his hangar with the airport authorities, spending money on architectural fees and copying costs pertaining to the design of his hangar, meeting with a prospective tenant to interest that tenant in renting out his hangar initially. But I think probably the overriding or ominous fact here is he obtained a contract from the developer to require the developer to build and sell him this hangar so that he could then sublet this hangar. Now, of course, my client would have had the ability to do much more in trying to further and interest tenants in his hangar, but the developer reneged on his promise. Thus, my client is stuck at that point. I see my time is up. I'll sit down unless there are other questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Cruz alluded to a 40-year ground lease in this case, and I believe Mr. Cruz said that Mr. Levis's damage calculation was based on this 40-year ground lease. I think one important fact to note, if you look at Plaintiff's Exhibit 9, Mr. Levis not only assumed that Tradewinds would earn the exact same profit over a period of 40 years, he also assumed at the end of the ground lease, if you look at the ground lease says at the end of the 40 years, the city of Colorado Springs gets everything on the property. Everything goes poof, city gets the property, everyone's kicked off the property. Mr. Levis assigned a terminal value at the end of the ground lease, and the testimony during his cross-examination, Mr. Levis said, well, my expectation is that that ground lease would have been renewed. So not only is Mr. Levis saying, I think that this plaintiff will make the exact same amount of profits over the next 40 years, he's also willing to say that in the year 2048, the city of Colorado Springs is going to renew that ground lease. So I think all of this shows the speculative nature of this case and Mr. Levis's testimony. And Mr. Cruz also referred to certain data collected by Mr. Tom Fellows, who's an appraiser in Colorado Springs. Critically, Mr. Fellows wasn't called by the plaintiff to testify at trial. It seems to me like a bootstrap argument. What Levis did is he had a bunch of numbers, and he said, Mr. Fellows, do these numbers look okay? Mr. Fellows says, yeah, those numbers look okay. I think you can go with those. But unfortunately, Mr. Fellows wasn't there to testify. He never provided an appraisal for this particular project. And I think that's notable that Mr. Fellows was not there to defend the opinions that he gave at trial. And finally, none of the information from the June 2005 appraisal for the project, none of the information from the November 2005 sales presentation was specific to Tradewinds or Mr. Freeman's hangar, and it all simply related to the project as a whole. Out of time, thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of counsel. The case stands submitted. Counsel are excused, and a written opinion will issue in due course. I'm going to check with